Hello, and welcome back to another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Arzu, a cancer survivor, as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. I'm also part of the Cancer Smart Initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about prostate cancer and its associated inequalities in the West Yorkshire and Harrogate area. I'm joined by fellow cancer champion, Rob.
Hi, Azu. Thank you for inviting me again. It's lovely to be here.
And we both have the privilege to interview a urologist from Bradford Royal Infirmary, Dr. Chidi Moloku. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Moloku.
Hi, Dr. Moloku.
Thanks for inviting me. Pleased to be here.
Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself before we actually start our podcast today?
Okay, so I'm Chidi Moloku. I'm a urologist, uro-oncologist, and robotic surgeon at Bradford Royal Infirmary. Mm-hmm. I've lived in various parts of the world, grew up in Nigeria, lived in Trinidad, the USA, and Canada as well, and currently live and work here in the UK. Mm-hmm. My training has sort of been a combined research and clinical training with special interest in prostate cancer and both scientific and clinical aspects of it. Currently, my remit here in Bradford is on the uro-oncology team, managing different urological cancers, but I still have a special interest in both clinical and research aspects of prostate cancer.
Wow, that sounds amazing, especially the fact that you've been, living in a number of different countries around the world and would have experienced healthcare systems that are quite different, I presume, as well.
Correct.
Okay, so as you said, you have a special interest in prostate cancer, and that is the main theme of today's episode. So, would you like to share some facts about prostate cancer and maybe a bit about the signs and symptoms, risk factors, and any other statistics?
So the prostate is a gland that is part of the male reproductive system. Mm-hmm. So it sits right under the bladder. The tube that drains the bladder passes through the prostate on the way out. And the prostate acts like a kind of junction for a lot of the tubing in the male anatomy. So the urinary tubes and also the seminal tubes that are coming from the testes that deliver the sperm that eventually becomes part of the ejaculation. Mm-hmm. About half of the ejaculation fluid is actually made in the prostate. And it contains a lot of different substances that help to keep the sperm healthy, alive, and swimming, because that's what they ultimately do. They try to swim to a particular destination. So the prostate produces some fluid that helps with that. It contains several buffers and several proteins that basically keep the sperm healthy. Mm-hmm. The problem with most organs in the body is that they can have what I'll call errors of duplication. So the way cells behave is that they divide from time to time. Some cells die, they have cells dividing and so on, and eventually some die off. But what happens is that each time the cells divide, there could be an error in the division. So it's like you're photocopying a document. Mm-hmm. Each photocopy, you might have a little bit of an error, a little bit of error. Each error, each time you copy might not really be a big difference, but when you look at the original and like the 20th or 30th copy, you might start to notice, hang on, this is not looking as good as the first one. So that's really what happens with cancer, is that with each division, there might be errors that potentially could cause problems like a cancer.
Yeah.
Also, some people are born with a genetic error already that with time manifests itself as a cancer. So the prostate is one of those organs that is in a man is susceptible to forming cancers. And what's interesting also is that in prostate cancer, we found that it's kind of part of the aging process in a man. So if a man lives long enough, very likely to develop prostate cancer. And we know this because men who have died in their 80s from other causes, when they've checked their prostate as part of an autopsy, they found 80% of them had cancer in their prostate, which wasn't contributing to their death. So prostate cancer is part of the aging process. And so it's not every prostate cancer that needs to be treated. But there are some men that either develop prostate cancer much younger, meaning that the life expectancy of, say, 80 years, if you develop it in your 50s or 60s, then there's a chance that it could progress to cause problems in your lifetime.
Right.
Also, some men, older men are diagnosed, but at the time they're diagnosed, they have quite aggressive kind of prostate cancer, which you know, if you didn't treat, could cause problems in their lifetime. So prostate cancer is one of those cancers that is quite common in men, but we're still trying to work out methods of deciding when you find it, which ones need treating and which ones don't need treating.
And like, what kind of signs and symptoms do patients present with when they do have prostate cancer? Like you said, you know, patients may be in an early stage or a late stage. So do the symptoms vary?
So prostate cancer on its own at the early stage doesn't really give any symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
There's a different condition of the prostate called benign prostate enlargement or benign prostate hypertrophy or hyperplasia, which is a different condition. It's not cancer. It doesn't change the cancer, but it also develops around the same age where prostate cancer starts to develop. So prostate cancer most commonly is picked up in the 60s. And BPH is also picked up mostly in the 60s. Now, BPH presents with symptoms because what happens with BPH is that the prostate starts to grow. And remember I said there's a tube in the middle that drains the bladder. If the prostate is growing outwards, then you don't notice a problem. You know, your prostate could get quite big without noticing anything. But if the tubes, if the prostate starts to grow inwards, then it could squeeze on that tube so that the man starts to experience difficulty passing urine, a weak urinary stream, maybe pain on passing urine, sometimes some bleeding while they're straining to pass urine, things like that, or going to urinary retention where they are completely unable to pass urine. So the men who also get prostate cancer, when it starts, initially, the cancer is quite small, it doesn't cause any symptoms.
Right.
But as it gets bigger, it could do the same thing that the BPH does, which is it could start squeezing on the water pipe, it could cause bleeding, it could cause other pressure symptoms in the area that could make you have symptoms. So the symptoms are similar, but with prostate cancer, when you start having symptoms, it's usually starting to be advanced. So ideally, you don't want a man to have symptoms from his prostate cancer because by then he might be limited with his treatment options.
Right. And like, is there a way in which you can differentiate between prostate cancer and benign prostatic hyperplasia? Like, do you have a screening program, for example, in the UK to do this?
So the way to actually differentiate is by a biopsy, i.e. take some tissue from the prostate and you look at it on the microscope and you could tell, is there cancer or no cancer? Obviously, you can't go biopsy every man, because the biopsy is a quite invasive test. In fact, previously it was done by the transrectal route, which means putting an ultrasound probe and a needle through the back passage to the prostate, which introduced infection a lot of times. And this change, we've kind of evolved a new technique, the transperineal route, which is through the skin between the scrotum and the back passage, which is cleaner, but even then it's still an invasive procedure. So we're thinking of other tests. So any less invasive test, how can you find this in a less invasive way? So the new, well, I'll call it a game changer really, is an MRI scan.
Okay.
MRI has been around for ages, but within the last sort of 5 to 10 years, we've found ways of using the MRI scan to pick up prostate cancer. And a lot of that work was led by urologists and radiologists here in the UK, in London, in UCL. So the UK is quite at the leading edge of using MRI to pick up prostate cancer. So you do a scan and the MRI could show you the inside of the prostate, which is much better than just the prostate finger examination we used to do, because it shows you on the inside and it could show you areas. It doesn't say it's definitely cancer, but it could give you high suspicion or low suspicion of whether that's cancer or not. It then informs you whether you should go on to have a biopsy or not. Mm-hmm. You combine that with a test called the PSA. PSA is prostate specific antigen. If you remember, I talked about all the different substances that were made by the prostate. PSA is one of hundreds of proteins produced in the prostate. But what's good about PSA is that it's 99.9% of the PSA made in the body is made in the prostate. So you can reliably say whatever PSA you pick up in the blood test is from the prostate. Now, most of the PSA that's made becomes part of the ejaculation, but a tiny amount of it is leaking out into the bloodstream all the time. So when you do the blood test, what you're picking is how much is leaking into the bloodstream. And there's no absolute normal or abnormal value, but we have sort of arbitrary cutoffs that we set and say, well, if your PSA is above this level, it needs looking into some more. So currently in the UK, guidance from the Public Health England recommends a value above 3. So in a man 70 or less, if the value is above 3, then it sort of triggers the need for a further investigation, which usually be an MRI scan, which again would show the inside of the prostate. That's another layer of testing. And if the MRI is clear, then there's some nuanced discussions to have with the patient whether or not to do a biopsy. But if the MRI is showing a highly suspicious lesion, then you go ahead to do a biopsy. And many of these men don't have symptoms while this whole process is happening. So we know that relying on symptoms for picking up prostate cancer is not really the best approach.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of other cancers, for example, like breast cancer or like bone cancer or like throat cancer, you know, patients do present with a lot of symptoms that are quite persistent and they can like extend to several weeks and get worse with time. But like with prostate cancer, you said that there are many patients who won't have any symptoms at all. And it's through, you know, checking the PSA levels and then having that MRI scan will you be able to actually determine, you know, if they have prostate cancer or not. Just touching upon the PSA levels, and would you say that it's sort of used as a tool for screening, or is it like, I know you said that the levels, if they are elevated, are associated mainly with your prostate because that's where the majority is produced, but would you say that it is, you know, a screening tool that we use, or an effective tool to be precise?
So screening is a very specific word in the health, in the public health and in the healthcare setting. So screening a screening program has certain characteristics, and for something to be used as a screening test, it also has to pass certain criteria to say this is a good screening test. And it gets a bit technical, but I'll just quickly run through some of the important things that a test needs to be able to do or show to be a good screening test. So first of all, the condition that you're screening for has to be an important health problem.
Okay.
It should also be an accepted and recognized treatment. So you should pick up the disease from screening. You should be able to screen and sort of treat with an effective treatment. There should be, you know, available facilities for diagnosis and treatment, you know, in the whole population that you're screening. There should be an early stage of the disease where if you screen and you catch it early, you can treat. There should be a suitable test. So the test has to be acceptable, you know, not a test that's, you know, too invasive. The natural history of the condition needs to be known. So you should know what should happen from beginning to the end if you don't treat, because then that tells you that treating is justified. There should be clear policies on who should be screened and who shouldn't be screened and who should be treated and who shouldn't be treated. It should also be cost effective. So you don't want to go into a screening program that's going to bankrupt the whole healthcare system. And also the screening test should be continuous. So you should, something that should be rolled out, you know, continuously, so that no particular group of population misses out on it. Now, the PSA test fails on a lot of these criteria.
Right.
It's one, it's not specific for prostate cancer because it also goes up when you have benign enlargement of the prostate.
Right.
I mentioned earlier about the prostate cancer, not knowing when you pick it up, who needs to be, sometimes we don't know who needs to be treated and who doesn't need to be treated. We know that the treatments for prostate cancer are quite invasive and life-changing in terms of the side effects. And we know that there's what we call over-treatment, which means that you treat a lot of men that don't need treating, and we're still trying to fine-tune who needs treating and who doesn't. So picking up prostate cancer could leave you in a bit of a dilemma as to whether you should have treatment or not, because you're thinking about whether this treatment is going to cause more harm than the actual disease itself. So there are a number of points at which the PSA test fails.
Okay.
But it's still a very good test, and it's even better for men who have already had prostate cancer treatment. So it's actually better for monitoring the effects of treatment. Because when you treat prostate cancer, for example, with surgery, you remove the prostate, then the patient's PSA should be almost zero. If the PSA starts going up in the future, then that tells you, hang on, there must be some prostate cells somewhere that's making the PSA. Similar for radiotherapy, it doesn't go to zero, but it goes to a certain number and sort of stays there. And if it starts going up in the future, then you know that there must be prostate cancer growing again. So it's actually better for monitoring post-treatment. There's lots of other tests, genomic tests and RNA and proteomic tests that are coming in to try and help differentiate between, you know, which cancers need to be treated and not treated. But this is an area that is still being developed, quite experimental.
Okay. And like, you know, with regards to prostate cancer, you mentioned that, you know, genetics and mutations can increase your risk of developing this. So, for example, you may be born with a mutation or you may develop this at a later stage in your life. So I guess that's one of the risk factors. But what other risk factors can, you know, contribute to prostate cancer in men?
So there are both, let's say, genetic and environmental.
Okay.
That's a good way to categorize it. So genetic means you're born with this, and then environmental means the environment, you know, is affected. And that includes everything, including your diet, lifestyle, all sorts of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they impact on each other. So, for example, you might be born with a genetic predisposition, but maybe if you expose yourself to some of the environmental things, lifestyle things, that could make you, that could trigger it earlier.
Right.
Or if you don't expose yourself to the environmental things, then it could make you get it later, even though you have genetic predisposition. This is an area that's still being studied, but we know that there's both of it, because we know that when you look at ethnic and racial populations across the world, there's clearly different rates of prostate cancer in different populations. So I just want to break it down in a simple way. We know that people of East Asian descent have the lowest lowest risk of prostate cancer. And then people from South Asia, so India, Pakistan, that sort of population are next. And then Caucasian, people of European descent are next, and then people of African descent have the highest risk. And this seems to hold true in every every environment where you have the mix of populations. So studies in America have shown that, studies in the UK have shown it. So we know that this is something that's definitely, there's a biological component there. There's a lot of work going on now, both in the UK and internationally, to try and pinpoint where the genes are that are important for this biological predisposition. There's a lot of work going on. And some genes have been found, but no one gene is such a strong predisposing factor. And it seems like it's a combination of so many little genetic changes that causes it. There's a gene called a BRCA gene, which tends to increase your risk of both prostate and breast cancer. But even that, it only accounts for a small population of the genetic prostate cancer, you know, 10% or less. So there's still a lot of work going on to find out what the genes are and how they work in combination to increase the risk. Environmentally, we know that there are environmental factors because I mentioned how East Asians, so I'm talking about East Asian cultures like the Chinese, Japanese, Korean population.
Yeah.
So when the population from that area moves to North America, you find a higher incidence of prostate cancer in East Asians living in North America than those living in East Asia. So that tells you that moving to America, for example, has done something in terms of the environment, whether it's the diet, where there is this amount of sunshine, where there's something in the water. These things were not so clear. You know, for example, you know, we know that the diet in East Asia is more about fish, vegetables, and so on. And they do depend a lot on a lot of herbal remedies, herbal teas, and so on, which are not so common in North America. It's more about sodas and pops and, you know, carbonated drinks, that sort of thing. So there definitely are a lot of lifestyle differences between the two that most likely are contributing.
Right. And like, you know, you mentioned how the differences in incidence of prostate cancer comes to light between the different, for example, ethnicities. So, you know, during your work in the Bradford area, is this something that you saw during your practice? When it comes to like cancer inequalities associated with prostate cancer?
So the Bradford area demographically is about 67% European, about 27% Asian, and the rest is a mix of Black and some Chinese and so on. So it's still majority European, but does have a high percentage of South Asian population compared to other cities in the UK. So because I said that the risk is lower in the Asian population, it's also reflected here. So most of our patients that come in with prostate cancer are actually European patients. A lot of studies about this has been done in the South, looking at how men present with prostate cancer between the ethnicities. Right. But we've just also started to look at that up here in Bradford. And in fact, there was a paper from Bradford here that was published earlier this year, just looking at, well, the title is Prostate Cancer in the British Asian Population, and it's a case control study. And what's basically showing is that men or Asian men in the Bradford area tend to have their prostate cancer diagnosed more symptomatically. So men who having symptoms versus men who've just had a PSA test and then that triggered the investigations.
Right.
We're also finding that when they do have prostate cancer, more of them are opting to monitor their cancer than to have it treated with surgery or radiotherapy. And also they seem to be presenting with disease that's a bit more advanced than their European counterparts or colleagues.
I was just going to say, is that an access to services or a reluctance to access the services? It's whether they take the services on or it's presentable to them, to these the local communities to come forward for treatment at GP level.
So now that we are picking up these differences, in fact, what we've decided to do, so this publication, so it was published in the Journal of Clinical Urology.
Mm-hmm.
The first publication online was December last year. What we've decided to do, because this study looked at 2010 to 2015, we've decided to expand it to go earlier and later to get a larger cohort and mm-hmm. actually now tease out all these possible issues. So is there anything to do with, is it to do with socioeconomic issues? So we're looking at the different postcodes, where the people being diagnosed, when you correct for, say, you know, socioeconomic factors, does the difference disappear? We want to find out a bit more about access. You know, we want to actually go out into the communities and tell the Asian men, look, this is what we're finding. What do you think are the barriers for you? But now we're armed with the information now that we started to study this. So we could actually go out into the population and ask them and say, you know, do a kind of more qualitative studies and ask, you know, what are the barriers? I mean, I could give my own anecdotal experience of what I see in clinic, but this is something that we need to study a bit more systematically, and we're planning to do that very soon. We'll start to apply for funding. Once we're able to put all the data together, we'll start to apply for funding to see if we can set up studies looking at this. Bradford Royal Infirmary, over the years, they've got the Bradford Institute of Health Research, and they've got the Born in Bradford study that's been studying populations for years now. So we could probably piggyback on that study and see whether we can try and tease out what's happening in the Asian population. If you ask for my anecdotal experience, what I would say is that there is a reluctance to present to GPs. Now, I'm not sure whether they're any sort of cultural barriers. There shouldn't be a difference in access to care, because everybody's got a GP, and
yeah.
Your GP is not going to, you know, decide to see one group and not see another group. So I don't think it's a problem of access or availability of care. There must be some sort of cultural barrier, maybe, that makes people reluctant. It might be due to the fear of having investigations or maybe a lot of misconceptions about what will happen when you go into hospital. You know, for example, using the recent COVID epidemic, there were lots of, within certain communities and populations, saying that don't go, if you have symptoms, don't go to hospital because you're definitely going to die. And they're injecting people with this and that. So you never quite know what the story is in the communities till you actually go there and ask them, you know, what are the issues? If you tell them, this is what we're finding, what do you think is the issue? And you might be able to get some feedback from them. The other thing is that when people come in, they are sometimes reluctant to have certain examinations done. And also when treatment is offered, for example, I had a patient who basically just refused to have treatment. And he said, let's see how it goes. Some want to try different herbs. And there's one whose daughter was expert in Ayurvedic medicine. And, you know, they had some things that they were trying and so on. And I'm not saying these things don't work. It's just that they've not been studied in an objective way to actually say, do they work? How do they work? How much do you need for it to work? How long do you need to be treated? You know, what kind of cancers does it work for or not work for? So my anecdotal experience is that there are probably some cultural issues that can be teased out some more as healthcare providers, to actually go out and find out what these issues are and how do we provide information to different populations in the way that they understand and that sort of sits well with them.
One of the things we've talked about previously, another guest, was community connectors, so to speak, or a community nurse from each community to to bring the information a bit more easily and see that there is no reason to be culturally afraid of seeing the doctor for a prostate issue. And one of the things that, you know, having seen a family member with prostate cancer and leave it too long and a friend do the same thing, it's trying to make sure that everybody doesn't feel reluctant to go for whatever reason and have somebody that they can relate to say, look, come along. If this is a symptom, you need to get it checked out. And it's a way to try and find the removal of cultural concerns that people can take up and get treated as quickly as possible.
So one thing, we, like I mentioned earlier, is that we've now realized, so the first study we did, we didn't look at, you know, postcodes and socioeconomic stratification, but we realized we need to do that because you might find that this might be a socioeconomic factor, or it could even be educational, you know, level of education and exposure that could be the difference. So you might find that even within the European population, there might be people from different socioeconomic classes that respond to healthcare and respond to presenting for assessment in different ways. So I think adding in the sort of socioeconomic stratifications would help us to tease it out much better.
And I think it is very multifactorial, like the cancer inequalities we see in, for example, ethnic minorities. Like you said, socioeconomic factors might factor, you know, be contributory, or like the level of education. I mean, you said that a lot of South Asian men, when they did find out they had prostate cancer, they didn't really want to receive treatment. They were more so, you know, leaning towards just like grateful watching and monitoring. Mm-hmm. And that might be because of the lack of education on the treatments that are available and, you know, how they're going to affect the body. So, like you said, it is, you know, a very large area where a number of factors need to be studied for us to make the best recommendations to overcome this.
The thing I thought was the new experience was that you can see that in the more poorer areas, the areas that are less well equipped, the surgeries have a higher level of patients. And I do think that in the poorer areas of cities, particularly areas, I mean, Bradford's not always an affluent area. There's large surgeries, there's long waiting times. People often are self-employed or work particular hours, and they don't go to the doctors, and waiting 2-3 weeks for an appointment is probably puts people off when they should just stick to it, I suppose. What you read is you see the issues with access for services, in that time plays a big factor in that.
Another thing I should mention, which may or may not be contributory, is that within the Asian population, there's a lot of gaps in their stay in the UK. So, for example, within a year, they might be spending like 3 months, 4 months abroad.
Right.
Which tends to interrupt sequencing of tests, treatments and so on, and recovery from treatments and so on. So for example, if they already have a trip planned to spend time 3 months, 4 months with family abroad or doing different projects, family engagements, family responsibilities, you know, the family setup, sometimes the kind of running, you know, family here and in, you know,
abroad,
back home abroad, yeah, wherever their family is originally migrated from. So very often they set out a block in the year when they need to be back, you know, with family abroad, and they don't want anything to interrupt that. And they'll tell you, okay, wait till I come back. Or so sometimes I think that could also contribute to interrupting their, well, I say creating a barrier to them actually having some continuity of care.
And like, I know Rob mentioned this idea of having like a family-based approach to encouraging people to access services. So like how, you know, we talked about education being a major factor that can either prevent a person from accessing healthcare. So maybe like younger generations, if they're more well-informed about prostate cancer, for example, or many of the other cancers, and screening and just treatments as well, they could potentially motivate maybe their fathers, brothers, grandparents to, you know, access the help they need. So like we said, I think through a family-based approach, because maybe that's more of a priority, I guess, for South Asians, we could overcome those barriers that we've been talking about.
The thing about it is that younger people tend not to be thinking about health issues. Younger people have other things, more interesting things to think about. They want to travel the world. They're chasing their career. They're studying, you know, getting married, having babies, you know. So when you're young, you kind of think you're invincible. So I'm not sure young people will be the best advocates to say, oh, you need to do this or you need to do that. I'm not sure. Maybe. But you find that it's when you kind of like hit maybe 40s or 50s that you start to realize, hang on, I can't do all the things I used to do like 10, 20 years ago. Then you realize, hang on, this health thing is real. And then you become a bit more conscious. But yeah, I mean, it's a combination. I do see people come with family. So patients come in with family, and you could tell from the interaction that the family sort of encouraged them to come. Some come with their partners, and you could tell their partners have encouraged them to come. So you do find a combination of different scenarios where family members could be the trigger or the encouragement for patients to come. I've noticed, you know, when men, especially like, for example, the Muslim Asian population, they're very comfortable when they come with their son to the clinic. I don't know the background to that, but you find that they're so confident when they come with their sons. If they come with their daughters, they're confident, but because by the nature of what, you know, prostate cancer is and kind of questions you need to ask, you start to get drift into certain questions where they're not so comfortable to speak about it with their daughters. So, it just presents a sort of interesting interaction. But I agree that family members, it's not a one size fits all, but the family members could sort of help as encouragement or the trigger for seeking assessment.
Yeah, I think it was because we thought that as research improves, detection improves, the subject isn't what it was 20 years ago. I mean, it was almost you don't talk about it. It was a man's cancer that nobody wanted to really talk about. And I think now as people's awareness comes on, people are more easy to ask questions about anything these days. And I think that it's a good sign. And as you say, to go along with your son to sort of say, you know, you're at risk. Have you been checked out? I think it's something that, you know, we've ourselves talked about, aiming what we talk about on the podcasts at a younger generation to get the older generation to think a bit more about breaking those barriers and going to get checked out.
And like, just to add, like, we've mainly been talking about South Asians, but you also mentioned how Black African men are very high risk, highest like the risk, highest yeah. risk of prostate cancer. So, you know, would you like to sort of expand on that as well a little bit?
So we know that both here and in the US, it's about twice the risk compared to the European population. So African men have about twice the risk than European men. Again, there might be, well, we know there's a genetic component to it, but there could be environmental factors as well. And some groups in the US, especially, they're looking at exposure to vitamin D level, you know, vitamin D and vitamin D levels and how that may or may not affect things.
Yeah.
I guess time will tell what all the other factors are. I have my own theory as well, but I'm still working on it and I can't talk too much about it. But, well, as we know, sort of Homo sapiens as we are, we all started originally in Africa and spread out. And there were other human groups in different parts of Europe. So you had the Neanderthals, you had the Denisovans in Asia and so on. And I've got a theory that the admixture might be contributing to prostate cancer risk. But it's something I'm still working on, and you'll be the first to know.
Oh, we'll look forward to hearing your theory.
Absolutely.
Yes, African men have a higher risk. And you see this, the Prostate Cancer UK website is very good at highlighting this. And this is something we know is an issue. You find that, well, the higher concentrations of Africans are mostly down south. I mean, even in Leeds, which is, you know, just next door, the African population is 3.5%. So it's still a fairly small percent of the population. But we need to find ways that are also culturally appropriate and culturally effective of reaching that population to make them aware that they're higher risk. What yeah. I do in my practice, for example, is if you have any of the risk factors, which I consider quite important, for example, African ancestry or family history, because we also know that family history puts you at higher risk. So one first degree relative, first degree is like your father or brother that has prostate cancer, puts yeah. up your risk by about 2.5 to 3 times. And the more first degree relatives you have with prostate cancer, it keeps increasing. So in my practice, men like that who come to clinic, I would definitely do an MRI scan for. So if you're African right. or you've got family history, it doesn't matter what your PSA is or what the examination findings are, I would encourage you to have an MRI scan. And if you have an MRI scan and your MRI scan is normal, then we need to have a conversation again about whether a biopsy is required or not, because we know that the MRI scan is not 100% accurate. It's about 90 to 95% accurate at best. So we do have what we call certain red flags that if a man has and his MRI scan is normal, I would still encourage to have a biopsy. So that's people with African ancestry, people with family history, and a few other red flags we have. So how it reflects in my practice is that those men I encourage to have investigations if they've got family history or African ancestry, just because we know the risk is higher in them.
And that makes sense, because like even with breast cancer, if you have a family history or like the BRCA mutations, they do suggest that you should start screening at an earlier age compared to, you know, the national program. So I think that's a very logical approach. And like, you know, like you said, for the Black men, for example, who don't have a family history of prostate cancer, or just men in general of any ethnicity, I think it'll be really helpful if you could educate them on certain lifestyle changes that they can adopt to reduce the risk of this cancer.
So prostate cancer is kind of shifty, meaning because it's a cancer that presents mostly in old age, it just means that, like I said earlier, most men are going to live out their lives without it being a problem. So even though it's common, not all men will have a prostate cancer that's a threat to their life.
Right.
So it's very hard to pinpoint what the exposure is that has caused you to have prostate cancer. I would say, for example, sorry. So dietary changes, for example, a lot of studies that have looked at diet have been conflicting. So some have shown, for example, let's say tomatoes, as an example, has shown that people who have a diet rich in tomatoes have a lower risk, but not just any tomatoes, it's actually processed tomatoes. So either cooked,
right,
or you know, ketchup type, you know, anything that's been processed have a lower risk. But again, some other studies have shown no effect, and we're not too sure why that is, why some studies are showing an effect and some are not. You have other things like a diet that's low in red meat, so people who have more fish for protein have a lower risk. People who have lower dairy product diet are reported to have a lower risk. And there are other things like cruciferous vegetables, which basically involves or includes cauliflower, broccoli, things like that. So these are the things that in large sort of population diet studies have shown are protective.
Okay.
Dietary studies are very difficult to pin down because, again, you're trusting people to report how much of whatever they had in the last maybe year or month or whatever. And it's just hard. How much do you need to take? How much is a serving? You know, does it make a difference if you're taking organic or non-organic? You know, so it's very hard to pinpoint these things. But we do know that basically a healthy diet or what sounds to be like a healthy diet is good for your prostate.
Yeah.
So basically, whatever is good for your heart is good for your prostate. And I have another theory about that because there's only two animals in the or mammals in the animal kingdom that develop prostate cancer naturally. Okay? And that's humans and dogs. Okay?
Wow.
Now, the closest relative to a human in terms of genetics and biology is a chimp, okay, and other great apes. So the question then you have to ask yourself is, why is it that the chimps and the other apes are not getting prostate cancer, and a distant, more distant mammal is also getting prostate cancer? So you have to ask yourself, well, what's similar between humans and dogs? What do we share?
Diet.
So for a long time, people just fed their dogs their leftovers.
Exactly. That's just what I was thinking.
So we eat the same stuff. So somehow, a disease that has skipped all your relatives and has gone to a more distant relative that you share the same diet with.
Yeah.
So that says something.
I think you're right.
And then you ask yourself then, okay, well, if chimps and gorillas and so on are our closest relative, what do they eat?
A lot of fruit, don't they?
And their diet is fruits, shoots, roots, fruits, shoots, roots, you know, and the occasional insect and so on for protein, right?
Yeah.
Mm. So they have a low protein diet, it's mostly vegetables. And then if you look, I have a nice picture of like the dentition of different types of animals, the herbivores, the carnivores, and the omnivores. And you find that the human dentition is much closer to the herbivores than it is to the carnivores. So without having to go into a lab to prove anything, right, just by observation, it follows that there must be something to do with our diet. I don't think it's something that you could wait till you're 65 and then you're diagnosed with prostate cancer. Like, oh, I'm going to go out and eat all the vegetables on the supermarket shelf. That's not going to work. So some patients are diagnosed and they say, okay, what can I change? What can I do? And I don't think any of these things could actually, well, we don't have evidence that any of these things could actually cure prostate cancer once you've got it. But if you're a young person in your teens, 20s, and you start on a healthy diet from then possibly over your lifetime, that might reduce your risk. Mm-hmm. So what I would tell men, well, actually young men, which plugs back into your using the younger people as advocates, is forget your parents and your grandfather. You need to make some lifestyle changes now that changes your outlook, changes your chances. You need to watch a bit of Discovery Channel, watch the apes, what are they eating? Fruits, shoots, roots, and a little bit of protein. I'm not saying protein is bad, because there's certain amino acids that we can't make or we can't get from vegetables.
But
I think turning our diet a bit more towards more healthy stuff, fruits, shoots, roots.
You're right, though.
And a touch of protein over a lifetime. So not when you have your diagnosis in your at 68, right? You can't go and soak yourself in a bath full of vegetables and all that and expect it's going to permeate your body and change your risk. It's a bit too late then.
Then you
have to go for hard treatment like surgery, radiotherapy, hormone therapy. These are all hard-hitting drugs and treatments. Whereas if you had made a lifestyle change much earlier on, you might have just changed your outlook over a lifetime.
I think you're right, though. We're the only meat eaters that have to cut it up.
There you go.
You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't eat meat anymore. I mean, one of the things when I went to treatment, I said, could you reduce your red meat intake, processed food intake? And I just give it up, you know, and I've noticed a difference in myself, just, you know, replacing meat in a dish with a different vegetable. So yeah, there is some benefit in that. I do have fish, but no meat for 3.5 years now. So, but yeah.
So basically, I mean, our bodies are made of mostly of water and proteins. And to make proteins, we need amino acids. They're the building blocks of proteins. I think there are about, 21 or so amino acids. And there's about two of them that our bodies can't make. So we need to have them in our diet. And those two amino acids are not commonly found in plant sources.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying meat is bad completely, but I'm saying we're talking about the amount.
Balance is key.
And the type of meat. We know that white meat, fish, and so on. Lean white meat is better than, you know, a lot of the red meat, high fat content red meat.
I wonder if that's why you were saying about it with South Asian men having an increased risk of prostate cancer in America, North America. They're prolific red meat eaters in North America. And I wonder if their diet gives that increase, which goes back to your theory on diet.
Yeah, so it must be a contributing factor.
Yeah. So whilst, I mean, we have been talking a bit about West Yorkshire and the Harrogate area, one of the things that we've talked about is it's important to highlight that the prostate cancer and all cancers are a national issue of concern, and particularly across the ethnic minorities, and raising or reducing the inequalities in those areas. Are there any programs that you can make us aware of that have been introduced in the West Yorkshire and Harrogate area that come from a more national background?
I would say that Prostate Cancer UK seems to be doing a very good job of awareness, supporting programs, supporting studies, and highlighting research findings in prostate cancer that are relevant to men and their families. I don't know of any specific programs in the Yorkshire area. There's Yorkshire Cancer Research that, you know, does offer funding. Well, you know, you can apply for funding to do studies in cancer that are relevant to populations in Yorkshire area. And, you know, us here in Bradford, our group here, we're looking to see how we could start to access some of those funds to support some of these studies that we're doing. But nationally, I think there's not been so much focus on the sort of ethnic disparities in prostate cancer. And I'm not too sure why. I mean, back as far back as 2006, there was a process study which was based between London and Bristol that did start to show some of these disparities. But I know that now that there's a group in the Institute of Cancer Research in London that's actually probably leading some of the genetic studies, trying to look at the different ethnic groups to see whether they could explain the biological role of different genetic changes and different genetic compositions to prostate cancer risk. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I know that there's the prostate cancer, Prostate Cancer UK website do a lot. And it's good to know that there is some research going on that, you know, can be highlighted to show that there is improvements in removing the inequalities. But yeah, it does.
And you also mentioned things like qualitative research to explore, like the attitudes, for example, of certain ethnic minorities. So I guess it's a number of different factors which you said need to be studied for us to be able to then tackle them and then overcome those kinds of inequalities. And I guess, you know, Rob and I are really pleased to hear that you're part of this particular, you know, research group that's making the effort to hopefully tackle these inequalities and overcome those barriers eventually so that we have more equality in cancer outcomes for all affected by prostate cancer. And like, you know, with that, I just want to say that I thoroughly enjoyed speaking to you today, Dr. Moloku. It was an amazing episode. I think I learned so much about prostate cancer, and I'm sure Rob will agree with me.
Absolutely, yeah, it's been a wonderful experience. I learned a lot as well, and maybe I need to learn a bit more as a man approaching 60, which is quite scary. But yeah, no, it's been wonderful. We do appreciate you taking the time and effort to chat with us and raise this very important issue.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Sometimes as healthcare providers, we need to think more about how we get our message out in a simple form that can reach people. And thanks to people like you who have set this sort of program up where, you know, you can create awareness and disseminate information. Sometimes we finish our clinics and we go home, we're tired, and we don't think about how we can actually get the message out into the community. So we really depend on programs like yours to help us with the work, because at the end of the day, as clinicians, the more aware and educated our patients are, the easier our job is. So yeah, we do appreciate the efforts you're making as well. And I'll say, you know, carry on with it.
Thank you very much. And you promised to come back as well, I believe. So we will hold you to that.
This podcast is brought to you by the West Yorkshire and Harrogate Cancer Alliance and patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. To find out more, visit us on our website, that's www.yorkshirecancercommunity.co.uk/cancersmile. Thank you.